Good morning. It is a pleasure to be with you all to open God's Word. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 11, verses 10 through 32 today. So go ahead and turn there. If I have not had the chance to meet you, my name is Ryan. I have the joy and privilege of being one of the pastors here at Arrow Heights. Whether you have been here 30 years or 30 minutes, we are glad that you're here with us today. There is a place here for you as we seek to trust and follow Jesus together. And today we come to a pivotal passage in our walk together through the book of Genesis. And I say pivotal not because it's an exceptional story or memorable account, but because as we conclude chapter 11 today, really we conclude part one of Genesis. We turn from what is often referred to as primeval history, which is the beginning of time up to Abraham, the father of God's covenant people, and prepare to step into what is known as patriarchal history. That's the time of the great fathers of the faith, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc. But just think of what we have been through as we conclude part one. From in the beginning, God, to let there be, and it was good. From the promise of the one to come who will restore all things, to Cain and Abel and a world steeped in sin. From Noah and the flood that destroyed everything on earth to Babel, where every nation was dispersed, we've walked together through some incredibly monumental history-defining accounts. And now what? Well, if Genesis were a big blockbuster Hollywood movie franchise, like the Marvel movies or something like that, chapter 11 would end part one, and we would have a big "to be continued" come up on the screen. Now, the good news for us is that it will be continued in 2 weeks. But you know how at the end of those big Hollywood franchise movies, everyone stays in their seats through the credits? And why? Well, because after the credits, there's always a brief 1 to 2 minute scene that by itself seems relatively insignificant. But in light of what is to come, sets everything ablaze with anticipation. It's a glimpse, a preview, a table setter for part two. Well, in a way, in Genesis, that's what today's text is. It's like that final after-credits scene that sets up what is to come. Because the goal of Genesis and the narrative thus far has been to get from all people to a people. To put names and faces on the promised Genesis 3:15 line, the seed of the woman through whom eventually the promised rescuer would come. And we saw through the genealogy of chapter 5 that this scarlet thread of God's remnant line was woven through Adam and Eve's son Seth all the way down to Noah's son Shem. And now today's text, hold on to your seats, is another genealogy. Today, we read the genealogy of the generations of Shem. And the purpose of this genealogy is not just to list the children of Shem. If you remember, we had that back in chapter 10, verse 21 through 31. But the purpose of this genealogy is to bring God's story to a man named Abram, later renamed Abraham, to whom God would give his covenant promise of a people. And now from the beginning of Genesis, we've talked about how the book is divided up into 10 toledoths, which is the Hebrew word that means the generations of. And these 10 toledoths serve sort of as markers of significant chapters in the Genesis narrative. And today, we cover Toledoth number 5, the generations of Shem, and begin Toledoth number 6, the generations of Terah. And by themselves, these are relatively short, seemingly insignificant texts. Yet these verses play a major role in setting up the rest of the entire Old Testament in a way that still calls to us today through the gospel of Jesus Christ in the new. So let's read Genesis 11, beginning in verse 10. These are the generations of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he fathered Arpachshad 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he fathered Shelah. And Arpachshad lived after he fathered Shelah 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he fathered Eber. And Shelah lived after he fathered Eber 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Eber had lived 34 years, he fathered Peleg. And Eber lived after he fathered Peleg 430 years and had other sons and daughters. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he fathered Reu. And Peleg lived after he fathered Reu 209 years and had other sons and daughters. When Reu had lived 32 years, he fathered Serug. And Reu lived after he fathered Serug 207 years and had other sons and daughters. When Serug had lived 30 years, he fathered Nahor. And Serug lived after he fathered Nahor 200 years and had other sons and daughters. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he fathered Terah. And Nahor lived after he fathered Terah 119 years and had other sons and daughters. When Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So verse 10 says, these are the generations of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he fathered Arpachshad 500 years and had other sons and daughters. So this genealogy in verses 10 through 26 has interesting parallels with the genealogy we read back in chapter 5. Because Genesis chapter 5 took us from Adam's son Seth to Noah's son Shem. Genesis 11 here takes us from Noah's son Shem to Terah's son Abram. Now both records have 10 generations and both end with 3 sons. The main difference between these genealogies, however, is tone. Because if you remember, in chapter 5, every person was listed and the children they had. And after that, we had the echoing refrain, and he died, and he died, and he died. Genesis 5 was a genealogy marching toward death and judgment. A judgment that was realized in Noah and the flood in chapters 6 through 8. But in Genesis 11, we don't have the refrain, and he died, concluding the account of every person on this list. And why is that? Well, though they obviously did die, the emphasis is not on their death, but on what they brought to life. Rather than marching toward death and judgment, this is a genealogy detailing the path towards life and promise. Now, as I said, we were given a genealogy of the line of Shem back in chapter 10, verses 21 through 31. So why do we need it again? Well, back in chapter 10, it was just a record of humanity multiplying. It was a record of Noah's sons and their succeeding generations. These are the sons of Japheth. These are the sons of Ham. These are the sons of Shem. But do you remember that somewhat strange passage back in Genesis 9? Where Noah curses his son Ham and blesses his son Shem as the one who will carry on God's covenant promise? Well, whereas Shem's genealogy in chapter 10 is a record of people, Shem's line in chapter 11 is a record of that promise. These are the ones through whom God is preserving his promised Genesis 3:15 line of a woman in opposition to the line of the serpent, Satan, the deceiver. Verse 12 says, when Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he fathered Shelah. And Arpachshad lived after he fathered Shelah 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he fathered Eber. And Shelah lived after he fathered Eber 403 years and had other sons and daughters. So this is one area in which we see the stage being set for the rest of the Old Testament and beyond. Because remember, the Shemites, the people of Shem, were referred to as Semites, which is a word used for the Jewish people. And in verse 14, we have Eber, whose line of Semites was referred to as Ebers, or eventually Hebrews. So already we have a line of people referred to as Semites or Hebrews, through whom the Messiah, the Christ, the Rescuer, will one day come. This is incredibly significant throughout the rest of the scriptures. Now verse 16. When Eber had lived 34 years, he fathered Peleg. And after Eber lived after he fathered Peleg 430 years and had other sons and daughters. Now remember, Peleg was referenced back in chapter 10, verse 25, as the one during whose days the earth was divided. And we read this division account last week in the Tower of Babel narrative. So now we have scattered, divided peoples among whom the Hebrew people live. Verse 18. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he fathered Reu. And Peleg lived after he fathered Reu 209 years and had other sons and daughters. When Reu had lived 32 years, he fathered Serug. And Reu lived after he fathered Serug 207 years and had other sons and daughters. When Serug had lived 30 years, he fathered Nahor. And Serug lived after he fathered Nahor 200 years and had other sons and daughters. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he fathered Terah. And Nahor lived after he fathered Terah 119 years and had other sons and daughters. When Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, do you notice something interesting taking place in these brief accounts? The lifespans of people are getting shorter and shorter after the flood, just as God said they would. Back in chapter 6, verse 3, when God said he would shorten human lifespans to around 120 years. Now, this is a subtly ominous undertone in the text. Now, what led to this was something different about the post-flood environment. was the accumulation of sinful living having negative effects on the body? Was this because more genetic defects were being copied and passed down as broken bodies with broken DNA multiplied in a broken world? Was this just God's sovereign decision to shorten human life? Well, yes, no, maybe, and perhaps all of the above. But either way, from this text, we see that people's lives were getting shorter, much closer to the world of familiarity in which we live today. And thus concludes the brief genealogy from Toledoth number 5, the generations of Shem, which have taken us from the great reset on the ark to scattered nations across the earth, one of which is the Hebrew people. Which leads us to Toledoth number 6, verse 27. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran fathered Lot. And so just as we read in the previous verse, Terah had 3 sons. Now again, in Genesis, repetition means emphasis. We are meant to see that something is significant about Terah and his sons. Now, one of Terah's 3 sons has a son named Lot. Why mention just Lot and not Terah's other grandkids? Well, the relationship between Lot and his family, especially his uncle Abram, is going to be significant for several future chapters in part 2. So Moses is setting up the narrative. Verse 28. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans. So one of Terah's sons, Haran, who is Lot's father, dies. Now, how did he die? We don't know. But we are told Haran died in the presence of his father, meaning his life was cut short. And Lot, his son, was left without a dad. We are also told that Haran died in the land of his kindred. That's Ur of the Chaldeans. Now, where is Ur of the Chaldeans? Well, I've got that map again from last week, and if you see our blue circle, that's Ararat, where the ark would have landed. There in the yellow circle is Babel, or Babylon, where we had the Tower of Babel last week. And in that orangish-brown circle, you'll see a city called Ur. Now, this Ur is most often identified as the city in what is today southern Iraq, about 140 miles southeast of Babel or Babylon. And this Ur was the place where Terah, his 3 sons, and their families lived. It was their home. And while we don't know a ton about Ur, we do know that it was the epicenter of pagan worship given to the god Sin, also known as Nana, who was considered to be a god of the moon. Now, during the time that Terah and his family lived there, the cityscape of Ur would have been dominated by a freshly built 3-tiered ziggurat, like a pyramid, built by Ur-Nammu during the beginning of the 2nd millennium BC. And each level of this ziggurat was colored uniquely, with the top level having a silver 1-room shrine to Sin or Nana, the moon god, where rituals were performed. The area also featured a burial plot where human sacrifices made to the moon god were laid. So note, in only a few generations since Noah and his family departed the ark as the holiest most righteous and frankly only people on planet Earth, humanity has devolved into pagan, idolatrous worship of God's creation. In this case, the moon. Oh, how far and how fast the children of man fall. Now, as we said, Terah, Abram, and his family lived in an epicenter of pagan idolatry. But even though they figure prominently into the second part of Genesis and beyond, don't think that they were chosen by God because of their righteous exemption from their culture. Joshua 24:2, Joshua tells the Hebrews, "Long ago, your fathers lived beyond the Euphrates, Terah, the father of Abram and of Nahor, and they served other gods." Terah and his family, including Abram, were pagan idolaters as well. We see this even in their names. Terah's name is related to the word for moon. Sarai's name, meaning queen, is a translation of the name for the moon god Sin's female partner. Milcah is the same name as the goddess daughter of Sin. Even Laban, which we'll read later, means white and was a term that was used of honor of the full moon. So far from hunkering down and holding firm to the person and principles of Yahweh God, as one scholar said, we should picture Terah's sons as standing on the ziggurat of Ur, gazing into the stars and bowing to the moon, an inbred family of idolaters. They did not represent a worthy line that was distinguished from the mass of guilty rebels. Unless God came to them on his own initiative, acting out of an unmerited grace that originates in himself, then Abraham and his family would have remained, as Paul later put it in Ephesians 2:12, strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. Verse 29. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. So to further set the stage for Abram in part two, we are told that Abram and Nahor, Terah's surviving sons, took wives. Abram's wife was named Sarai, and we aren't given any further information about Sarai in this text, but from Genesis 20:12, we learn that Sarai was Abram's half-sister, the daughter of his same father, Terah, but not of the same mother. Meaning Terah, Abram's father, had either taken multiple wives or he had relations with someone in Ur who was not his wife, whereby Sarai was born. Now Nahor, named after his grandfather, we see in verse 24, married a woman named Milcah. Okay? Now try to follow along closely. Nahor, Milcah's husband, was also the brother of Haran, Milcah's father, which means Milcah was also Nahor's niece. You know, this seems very strange to us in 21st century America. Though marriage between relative family members was not uncommon in these days in the ancient Near East. But the point of all this is to show that God did not choose Terah and his family because they were perfectly righteous, bright, shiny, happy people holding hands. As mentioned previously, they were inbred, pagan, idolatrous moon worshipers. Certainly, these aren't the types of people that God would choose to use. Right? Verse 30. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. This comment stands out strikingly amidst passages upon passages of genealogies and generations. While everyone else lived X number of years and birthed XYZ before living X more number of years, and their kids who had kids, we are told that Sarai was barren. She had no child and could have no child, which in this time, place, and culture would have been a scarlet letter of shame, embarrassment. Sarai would have been looked down on as one who was being judged by the gods. Her hope of legacy, of help and support and community from having a family was all but dried up for her and thus for her husband, Abram. Now, Sarai's barrenness sets up another important part of God's story to come in part two. Verse 31. Terah took Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So Moses, as he's recording this, knows that this is getting confusing with all the names and the relationships, so he's very careful to color in the relational narrative for us. Again, we have Grandpa Terah, along with Terah's son Abram and Abram's wife Sarai, along with Terah's grandson Lot, who was Abram's nephew, the son of Abram's deceased brother. They all set out together from Ur to go to Canaan, yet settled in the land of Haran, not to be confused with Abram's brother Haran. And there, Terah dies. And thus concludes the brief end scene that previews part two and puts a final bow on part one. And as the camera pans back on the landscape, fading to black, we see Abram, Sarai, Abram's barren wife, and their nephew Lot standing alone in Haran. And as we conclude chapter 11, we are left with so many loose strands and hanging questions. For some reason that we aren't told, Terah uprooted from the home of his kindred in Ur to go to the land of Canaan. Now remember, Canaan was Ham's son who was cursed in Genesis 9 by Noah as one whose generations would be antagonists toward, yet eventually servants of, the line of Noah's other sons, Shem and Japheth. So as such, the people and the land of Canaan would not be receptive or hospitable territory for Terah, who is from the line of Shem. Now, perhaps they just didn't know the blessing and the curse. Or perhaps they just didn't care, thought it was all superstition. But either way, for Terah to uproot his family and go to Canaan would have been a very strange move. Why did they leave Ur of the Chaldeans? Why were they going to Canaan? What happened to them along the way? Why didn't Nahor, Milcah, and Iscah go with them from Ur? Why is it just Abram, barren Sarai, and their nephew Lot who are left in unfamiliar territory at the end of this scene? So many questions, setting the stage for what we will find in part two. But as we conclude this sweeping account that takes us from the dawn of time to a pagan city in southern Mesopotamia, before we move on to Genesis part 2, we would be remiss if we didn't reflect and ask, what have we learned from Genesis part 1? Well, we've learned many things from our collective beginnings. We have learned many realities that are not just relics of ancient history, but are realities that impact our every thought, action, and deed today. From Genesis 1, we learn that Yahweh God, Elohim, is the sovereign creator of all things. He is the first mover, the author, the architect, the king, the authority over all that is. He is transcendent over time, space, and matter, and he has displayed both his character and his glory through his creative work. In Genesis 2, we learned that this God created humankind uniquely, purposefully, and specially for his glory. God created humanity as his image bearers to reflect his will and his way according to his perfect order, design, and purpose for his creation. From Genesis 3, we learn that now, by their own choice, mankind lives in an ongoing state of rebellion against God and his will and his way. From our first parents, Adam and Eve, we are all born set as enemies against our good creator with a sin nature that desires to define our own order, design, and purpose for ourselves, for our own glory, instead of God's. We want the throne that only God can occupy. We saw this unfold from the first murder in Genesis 4:8 to the first redefinition of God's gift of covenant marriage in Genesis 4:19. Humanity continually attempts to reform foundational morality and reality into its own desired image, calling evil what God has called good and calling good what God has called evil. And through Genesis 4 and 5, we saw humanity is divided according to God's promised line of the woman in Genesis 3:15, which will be the remnant that he reserves for himself by his grace, and the line of the serpent, who will continue to live at enmity against God and his remnant people. And we followed those lines through the genealogies of Genesis. In Genesis 6 through 9, we saw that God is a God of righteous judgment and merciful deliverance. Chapter 6, verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And accordingly, God decided to wipe everything that breathes off the face of the earth with a global flood. Humanity would receive the justice it deserved. Yet, God would deliver Noah and his family by his grace. And then Genesis 10 through 11, we saw that despite God starting over with the most righteous man on earth, even that man and his family could not escape their sin nature. Man's rebellion against God continued, though God's sovereignty prevailed. And in the end, we are left with Abram, Sarai, and Lot. Pagan moon worshipers from Ur heading west into the unknown. And throughout it all, just like our ancestors, we are left longing for our home back in Eden. we're left looking for the promised one to come, the rescuer, the snake crusher, the Messiah, the Christ who will put an end to evil's penalty and its power and its presence. Yet we also know, as God said in Genesis 3:15, this one who will crush the serpent's head will be struck himself on his heel. He too will undergo a violent and tragic wounding. But how and when would he come? What would be his wounding? How would he destroy the enemy, conquering even death itself, that his people again might live with God in their home for eternity? How could such a story that seems so far from Eden and Ararat, so far from Babel and Ur, not only be true, but find its beginnings and its foreshadowing and its early echoes from these very lands and these people and their stories? Well, for the answer to that, I again invite you to our Good Friday service and to celebrate Easter with us next Sunday. Because as we will clearly see, Genesis is only the beginning. Let's pray. Oh God, your ways are above our ways. Your understanding far beyond our understanding. Your goodness, your holiness, your righteousness far beyond what we could even fathom in this world. And God, as we have read these stories, these accounts, God, we've been joyful and in awe of who you are, what you have done. God, we have been so sorrowful for what mankind has done, the way that we have rebelled, your statutes that we have tried to redefine for ourselves, the path we have tried to forge. And God, we mourn those because we see them so clearly in ourselves. God, I thank you for your word that is so honest with us. And God, from these humble beginnings, you have been writing a story that finds its culmination in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus the Christ, God the Son in human flesh, nailed to a Roman torture device, bearing the weight of our sin, the sacrifice that brought us peace with you. Help us to see Jesus. Help us to love you. And help us to live for you gladly and joyfully as we surrender our lives back to you. It's in your name that I pray, Jesus. Amen.